All right, Bible and science. Probably, 25 years ago now, I had taught math in high school for 15 years or so, and somebody in our science department left, and I was in the math department at the time, and the science department teacher conned the principal into forcing me to teach science, which at the time I was all upset about because I had all the curriculum all set up for math, I had all the classes ready, and I had all these good math students and stuff. I really didn't want to teach science. It was a lot of work. But they moved me into biology, which at the time I thought was like, ugh, biology. That was my minor. I'd only taken on a minor in college because I had gotten through college so quickly, I didn't really have a minor until the last year when I realized I needed a minor to graduate because I didn't have a counselor in college. And all of a sudden I realized I had a minor, so I just went back and took biology because it was just something I liked, and I figured I could get through, have a minor, and maybe that would be something they'd want to hire you for. But I never intended to teach it. It turned out, though, for the last 20 years I was teaching, I taught biology every year and AP biology for probably the last 15, and really enjoyed it because it gives you an opportunity to get into the field and find out some things about science that otherwise I would have never known. I used to attend, when I was a young person like you, we used to have the, I think the unamended group up here used to run in, over there in Hamilton, they used to run these Bible and science seminars every year. Somebody, I think it was Ted Farr or somebody back then that was running them, and they'd bring in scientists from all over the place in different fields, in geology and biology and chemistry, and they would talk to us, and we could go up there once a year, and they would have these Bible and science seminars. I really enjoyed them. They were like, to me, that was a lot of fun, and I always used to like science. So anyways, after I got into biology for a few years and started teaching, I was really glad in the end that so God had sort of like shifted me into that field, even though at the time it was rather painful. It turned out to actually be a good change in my career, and I stayed in biology for the rest of my life. And the good thing about it, for any of you that are thinking about becoming teachers, the great thing about just getting into that kind of a subject area is that you can only teach those classes. So that for me then was when I taught biology and AP biology, I knew every year what I was going to teach. That's all I could teach in the science department at the time. And so, whereas in math, I mean, you could teach like algebra, pre-algebra, geometry, advanced geometry, trigonometric geometry, you know, you could teach all these different calculus, everything. You had to be around to teach all of those things in math. In science, they don't expect you to do that, so that was wonderful. Anyways, I used to find it a lot of fun to look at science in the Bible, and what really, I guess, what perturbed me a bit in our community is that sometimes people think of science in a negative way. They think that, like, science is against the Bible, and that really bothered me because, really, science isn't against the Bible. Good science actually supports the Bible. So that's the kind of stuff that I want to look at tonight. When you start looking at science in the Bible or, you know, in terms of what's actually happening, you have to realize that scientists make mistakes. That's okay. That's actually part of science. Most scientists admit, the honest ones, that the stuff that we teach on any given day, you know, a good percentage of it is going to be wrong. Because we're going to find out someday that things we thought were right are wrong, and we'll have to correct that. So science, when you watch it over the years, has constantly been changing. And that's part of the field, because you only know what you can collect data on and what you can investigate. And the more data you have, the better job you can do. So sometimes the bad scientist comes from incorrect interpretations of data. Sometimes it just comes from the fact you don't even have the data. It's just somebody's guess. They're taking a best guess at what's actually going on. So you can't always, you know, blame them for those kind of things where sometimes they do make mistakes. I did think this was interesting. I was just noticing, this is just November 26th, just, you know, what, 6 weeks ago or something like that. And the scientists discovered an invisible shield around the Earth. And it baffled us how it was formed. They really don't know where this came from. Didn't even realize it was there. There's some other ones there that they had known about, but didn't know about this one. But the interesting thing was, when you go back and look at it, immediately the scientists understood what it does. They knew right away what it does, because the way they were investigating it, they perceived it based on the fact that it was blocking these electrons from coming in from deep space. When you have these solar flares and different things, and stuff is sent out from the sun, things would come into our planet that would kill us if there wasn't some kind of protective shield that was out there. So they found out the purpose of the ring was quite clear to the researchers. The ring is used to block these killer electrons from entering deeper into Earth's atmosphere, and they can be extremely devastating and so on. So right away they knew what the purpose was. But a lot of scientists, although they can tell you the purpose, they don't make the connection then that, wait a minute, this must be by design. this doesn't just randomly come along that this planet has this protective ring out there. This is something that is by design. And God and his angels have been constantly doing things on our planet that allow life to exist. And there's a whole bunch more things that they're probably doing that we don't even know about. So that was just one recently. I thought it was interesting when you look at Einstein, you know, one of the greatest science people that ever existed, a fantastic mind to be able to do research. He said that when I see the glories of the cosmos, I can't help but believe that there is a divine hand behind it all. And that's what an honest scientist should really come away with. When you look at the design that's there and you understand how it all works together so well and the mathematical basis for how it's all organized, then you're just impressed that there must be some divine hand that's organizing all of this and has put it all together. Now, I think it's good to know that science people do make mistakes. We tend to think of science today, people hear about scientists have done a study and they've done some kind of research and they've discovered this or that, and right away we tend to think, well, oh wow, science has learned this, must be right, right? Science research, they did the research and came up with a conclusion, it must be the right thing. It isn't always right. Science people make mistakes. That's inherent as part of science. You're going to find that they goof up. So if you go back in history and look at some of the mistakes of science over the years, this wasn't all that long ago. Right until the middle of the 1800s, in our science books, they sort of laugh at it today, but they had these recipes for like how you could make things spontaneously generate. So they believed at this time, these were science people, they honestly believed that things could just spontaneously generate from inanimate stuff. Is it killing your ears? I can actually hear that. Can you hear that? Usually I can't hear it. When you get to be 30-some years old, you're going to find out you lose the ability for those high-pitched tones. See? So that some guy realized that, and he developed a ringtone called the mosquito ringtone for phones. Mosquito ringtone, so that when it goes off in school, the kids could hear it, but we couldn't. They thought that was so cool, because that way they could still use their cell phones, and their phone could go off, and they could hear the ringtone, but the teachers couldn't, because most of the teachers were over 30. But see, I got back at my class, and I figured, all right, I can't hear this. I downloaded it onto my computer. I put the mosquito ringtone on there, and every time the class was getting a little rowdy and I needed their attention, I would crank it up and get their attention and just say, what's the problem? I don't hear anything. You know? And they'd be like, oh, it's terrible. It's like anyway, so spontaneous generation. What happened in science is that they couldn't understand how living things generate all the time. Now, if some mom has a baby, that's a different story. Like, you know, if a mammal of some kind, cats have babies, everybody knew where the babies came from. But when you look at things like maggots, you know, that crawl around and meat like that, you little maggot worms and stuff that you see crawling around on dead animals that are out there, they couldn't figure out where they came from. So they just thought that they spontaneously generated from the meat and the dead animal. So they used to have recipes on how to create maggots. You know, you could take some dead snake meat or something and put it in a bowl and leave it there for a day or so, and maggots would just show up, you know, out of nowhere. That was how they came up with maggots. And frogs was another one that really fooled scientists for a long time. They couldn't figure out how frogs came out of ponds in the spring. When the pond froze over in the spring, and you know, they figured everything had died in the pond, and in the next spring the pond would thaw and these frogs would come right out of the mud, so they thought they spontaneously generated from mud. It wasn't until Louis Pasteur came along in the 1800s when he finally was able to answer some of these questions about spontaneous generation, and scientists finally realized that, oh, this really isn't true. You don't really get life from non-living things or dead stuff or whatever. That life comes from life. And you know, you grew up, probably went to a science class where everybody taught you that, and that was now known as a fact. But back then, that was not the case. So they do make some mistakes. Another big one that turned up, you know, I was looking at in my lifetime, because when things came along back in the early, in the 40s and the 50s, in science, by the time they made it into the textbooks, it was in the books in the 60s or so. But originally, scientists thought, when you started looking at the origin of life, all the science research seemed to point at the fact that the debate was whether it was proteins. What was it? How do we get all these different forms of life from cells? They wouldn't analyze what's inside a cell. They found out that cells have a lot of different versions of proteins, and really this DNA stuff only comes in, what, four forms? So it's like, how in the world could that account for all the different forms of life? Proteins are made out of 20 different amino acids. It must be the proteins. The vast majority of scientists thought in the end that proteins would be responsible for heredity. And it wasn't until 1944 when Avery discovered that only DNA could change one kind of bacteria into another form of bacteria. Or in 52, when Hershey and Chase finally showed that when viruses take over cells, they use these bacteriophage viruses that sort of land on a cell, and then they inject their DNA inside the cell, and the protein casing stays on the outside. And they were able to show with radioactive DNA that you could actually prove that only the DNA would enter the cell, and the DNA took over, and it actually manufactured more virus particles, so it must have been the DNA. But finally, in the 50s, Watson and Crick were the two that actually came up and finally discovered the structure of DNA, and were able to describe into the late 50s and early 60s actually how it works. Now, when you guys went to school, and you go right now, didn't most of you get taught how DNA works? Don't they teach that as a standard biology class now? So you guys all got taught this. You know, but even some of the things you were probably taught about DNA aren't totally accurate. You know, most of it is, but there's always mistakes that are made along the way because we don't really understand, you know, exactly how things work. Like for years in our textbooks, it used to say that DNA, where is the DNA? Where is it in a cell? In the nucleus, right? You know, so we all got taught in school that DNA is always in the nucleus. Well, it turned out that wasn't quite right, was it? Because some of you that are biology people know, where else is DNA found in a cell? And the mitochondria, that's right. Mitochondria have their own DNA. Nobody knew that for a long time, right? But they need that because they're manufacturing proteins so quickly in order for you to do metabolism. They have to have their own protein, their own DNA code. They manufacture their own proteins that are basically for mitochondria. That, by the way, is how they track human ancestry. You ever wondered how they proved that Thomas Jefferson had a child by his slave woman years ago, and how do they actually prove that today? You track mitochondrial DNA, because mom always passes mitochondrial DNA to her daughter, to the next daughter, because it always goes through the egg. And you can track heredity that way through mitochondrial DNA. Anyway, those are all cool things that go on in science today. So that science is really a lot of fun when you understand how it works. Now, here's another one. Back in the 1912 or so, there was this big thing going on in England. You know how the English people are like really big on England? They're very nationalistic, right? Well, when these different people around the world were finding fossils in Africa and these different places, the English really thought they were the top-notch, you know, race, the English people. So they wanted to make sure that the original human was in England. And so they had this fella that was Charles Dawson back then, and what he did, as we now know, is he put together some stuff from different sources, but he presented this skull called the Piltdown Man, and he claimed that he found it in England. And so this was now going to be support for the fact that the English were the original human people, and you know, they were still the top race that was out there. So Arthur Woodward, he reconstructed a skull and everything, and this is the way it looked. This is the way they presented the man of Sussex, England, right there. This is back in the early 1900s. And this was actually accepted. This guy was in the British National Museum and the whole works, you know, and for 30 years, people accepted this as truth. And I think the British really wanted to believe it. That's what happens in science. Sometimes they want to believe things that really aren't true. Well, it turned out in the end that really, it was an old human skull and a recent orangutan jaw that had canine teeth that had been filed down. The guy produced a fake, faked all these scientists out, and for 30 years they didn't realize it was a joke. But this is what happens sometimes in science. There's such a push for trying to get across a concept, or you want to, like today the real thing is about funding, that people will sort of fudge data sometimes in order to keep the funding going. And so it's just one of the problems that you run into, that periodically you're going to find information get out there that really isn't true. So when you start looking at things like evolution, the evolution of life, Andrew sent me this just recently, and he said, Dad, I'm sure you can use this at Attica somehow. And I said, okay, I'll put it up there at Attica. But anyway, that was for Andrew. Plus, you got some snow today. So it is a bit absurd, though. When you start looking at how life really works, I'm just amazed that so many science people have been fooled into thinking that all of this that we see today could possibly evolve just by random chance. And what they'll do is they get away from random chance and just say, well, life isn't random, that life actually has direction to it. But it really is still, all the mutations are just random chance. And so in the end, that's really what it is. But what does the Bible say? The Bible says that in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And I really believe that, to be honest to that today, that we have to realize that in that beginning, we don't really know when that was. I really think we cause ourselves a lot of trouble as a community if we try to argue the case that in the beginning was just 6,000 years ago. I really don't think the Bible presents it that way. In fact, even in the original Hebrew, there's a break between those sections there in verses 1 and 2. That wherever that beginning was, God created the heavens and the earth. For all of you that are like John Thomasites and you follow John Thomas's writings, I mean, he actually believed there was a previous creation as well where the angels came from. So this is not something new. This is just what people were trying to put pieces together and understand. That probably in the beginning, whenever that was, God did create the heavens and the earth. That's what the Bible has to say. So there really was a beginning to our universe. And that's an interesting concept because science actually supports that idea, that there was a point in time in which our whole universe was created. All those planets out there in space, all those things that the Hubble spacecraft has found, there was a point in time in which all of this stuff was, well, it all began. And that all this energy and everything used to be in one central focal point, and it all blew out from there. And what scientists tried to figure out for years, if that's the case, then what is it? What's happening today? What we're used to today is that if something blows out, that eventually it comes back down. And they were starting to worry, well, if the whole universe blew out from a central point, then all that matter is going to be attracting itself, and eventually someday it's all going to come back together again. Because matter tends to attract itself like that, and they would all, like, in forces that are working with. So they talked about the universe being a collapsing universe. Then other people said, well, wait a minute, what does the data say? Does the data show that that the planets are getting closer together, or does it show that they're getting further apart? And which one did they discover? What kind of a universe do we now think we live in? Science class people.
An expanding universe.
That the universe is actually getting further and further away. That when God blew out the planets and he set them in their position, he did it in such a way that they didn't just stabilize. It's not static. He actually made it so that they continue to move out further and further away. Well, that bothered some people too, because if we have an expanding universe, I think what Einstein did to show that was he took a balloon, put little dots on the balloon, and he said, if you have an expanding universe, then basically what happens, if all those little dots right there are different planets, what happens as they expand? Are they getting closer or further away from each other? They're getting further away. And so what's really happening in our world is that all the planets, the stars, everything, are continuing to get further and further and further away from each other. And then that bothered science people a lot, because if that's the case, what's causing that to happen? Right? Why would they continue to keep moving out like that? Why haven't they stopped? So then you hear about all this stuff about, like, dark energy coming up in theory about different things that maybe would be creating this, and now they think that maybe dark energy is responsible for, what, 70% of the energy that's out there in our universe. So anyways, they're still learning. But from all of that, what I always found interesting in science is that nobody can explain in science. All those physicists and those astrophysicists, they can never explain what caused all the energy in the first place to all be in one focal point. They don't answer that question. Instead, they start out with, here's all the energy at a focal point, and it all expanded out, all right? But why did it all collapse? Why was it all there in the first place? Whereas for us, we can say, well, look, what God did is he created all of this. At one point in time, he expanded it all out using his energy, and he literally blew out our universe from one central point and created all of these planets at that time. So in Hebrews 11 and 13, 11 and verse 3, that we looked at before about faith, faith is what allows us then to understand by faith. This is not blind faith. This is faith in believing based on evidence that's out there that we can see of how God has created the sky with the sun and the stars and used them to represent spiritual principles. He was responsible for this, but we understand that the world was created by the word of God so that what is seen was made out of things which do not appear. And that is so literally true. It's unbelievable how true that is. That all of these things that we see today, when you look at each other and you see your face and you look at things that you sit on your chair that seems to have so much mass to it. You step on the floor. Just never going to get used to these mics. You step on the floor and you think, well, that floor is so hard. Or imagine some of you guys playing football today when you went down on that field and you hit the ground. It's like, that's hard ground down there. And so all of those things that you see and you experience were literally made out of things which do not appear. And it turned out that was really true. So when you start looking in science and in terms of physics and try to understand, well, how was our world really created? What did God do when he made our planet? When he made all of these things in our world that we have today? What we now think happened is that you talk about energy. And they go back to, like, some of you maybe have heard of, like, string theory out there in terms of, like, how matter is developed today. So the current theory that's out there is that matter is probably composed of all these little vibrating strings of energy, which is probably what God did. He used his energy, and he compiled his energy into things that we could now see, things that we can actually understand and work with. So that for years, people thought, like, you know, when we went to school, you know, actually my dad, I guess, when he went to school, they would have taught him the smallest particle that could ever exist is atoms. Atoms were the smallest. Because they only had technology at that point to know about atoms. When you guys went to school, well, actually, when I went to school, they told us the smallest particles that exist were protons, neutrons, and electrons for composing atoms. Those are subatomic particles. When you went to school, what did they teach you? What are protons and neutrons made out of? Quarks. Now we have things that protons and neutrons are made out of, quarks. And then it's like, well, what are quarks made out of? And you get down into string theory in terms of, like, what this is actually had. So that God took energy, compiled energy into quarks, up quarks and down quarks, composed them into protons and neutrons, depending on how many up and down quarks you have, and he created the electrons, and he built atoms, literally built them out of things that did not appear. And it turned out that really is true. In terms of, like, you know, when you study atoms in school and you see pictures of atoms, scientists now tell us that if you blew up the nucleus of an atom, and you remember the subatomic particles that are in the nucleus? What's in the nucleus of an atom? School time, right? Protons and neutrons, right? Protons and neutrons form the nucleus of the atom. If you blew up the nucleus of an atom, and you took, like, an atom, probably like a gold atom, and you blew it up so that it's this big, here's the nucleus of the atom. All right, the nucleus of the atom doesn't really give atoms their space because it's the electrons. It's the force field created by the electrons that give atoms really their 3D component. Now, if you blew up the nucleus of a gold atom and made it be as big as this ping pong ball, and you then looked at electrons. Now, electrons relative to the protons and neutrons, they're only like 1/1800th the mass of a proton and neutron. They're really, really small. So they would be like a little pinhead. And where would the electrons be if the nucleus of the atom was this big? Where would the electrons be? Would they be out this far? Would they be as far as the wall? How far out would you have to go for the first electron shell? Anybody know? Over half a mile. Kilometer for you Canadians, right? So you'd have to go a half a mile to get to the first level of electrons. You end up going out like 7 or 8 miles when you get up into the third orbital that's out there. So finally, a guy named Rutherford discovered that really atoms are made of just empty space. They're just a bunch of, they're like blow-up things. They're like going into those little kids' things that they, when you go to the carnivals and stuff and they go into the balls. You can walk around and play in those balls and you can stand on them. But really, if you look at their little plastic balls that are in there, they're really just full of air inside of them. They're really empty. But they give three-dimensional space. And if you get enough of them, I could actually go in there and lay on them and they can support all of my body mass. And that's what's actually happening on the floor right now. When you put your feet on the floor, there's all these little subatomic particles with electrons whirling around way out there, 10,000 times further than the nucleus of the atom, and they're creating atoms that you can stand on, and when you stand on a million and a billion of them, they actually can support your weight. But really, if you stop the electron force fields, if you stop those fields, those electromagnetic fields that electrons are creating, scientists figure that if you stop those and you let all of that energy just hold still for a moment and it all collapsed, that all of the matter of our planet, all of it, would fit into a basketball. That's all it takes for our whole world. We all fit in a basketball. So when God says that that he literally created things, that by faith we understand that the world was created out of things which do not appear, that is literally what God did. He created something and put in laws of physics that allowed him to take energy and expand it all out into our whole world, and really all it is a basketball size worth of energy to him. In fact, if you just get it down to strings, it probably takes up less space than that. That's all it really is. And I find that kind of stuff is really interesting when you start looking at what God actually did. So when you look at diagrams in school, I'll take you back to the school days, right, and atoms and all that kind of stuff. When you look at these kind of diagrams right there, a lot of the books never tell you they're not in proportion. That's not really what an atom looks like. If this is really the electron clouds out here, and these are really the orbitals for the electrons, they couldn't show you the protons and the neutrons. So the artists all cheat. They blow them up real big so you can see them. But really, that's not the way it works. Really, they're so small, you'd never be able to see them. So that's actually how God put it all together. Now, I can still remember when I was teaching biochemistry for the first time, I can remember going through this with a class, and it just blew my mind because we were talking about carbon atoms, and we were getting into biology because it was a biochemistry class. It was the chemistry related to the biology that we were leaning into. And so I was telling the kids about all the different atoms that we were going to use for building biomolecules. We're going to build like carbohydrates and proteins and stuff. So which atom is the basis for building all the forms of life on this planet? You can cheat and look. Carbon. Everything's built out of carbon. Carbon, which is pretty simple, right? Carbon. So you start to analyze carbon, right? You go back and look at it. All right, carbon. Now, why is that the atom that you start with to build molecules of life? Well, carbon has only 6 electrons. It has 2 of them in its first shell. It has 4 of them that rotate around the other shell, the outer shell. And so that gives you only 4 there, but it takes 8 electrons for that atom to stabilize. So carbon needs to go around and sort of share electrons with other atoms all the time. So it goes around at different atoms and says, hey, oxygen, will you share some electrons with me? Yeah, good, I'll share a couple with you. Well, you want hydrogen, you want to share electrons with me? And so what carbon does, it's so unstable, it's always trying to bond with oxygen, with hydrogen, and it's trying to make other molecules. So you get things like carbon dioxide, that stuff we exhale out there. That's carbon and oxygen bound together. Or you get methane gas, CH4, that stuff that you, hopefully they're burning downstairs in those boilers to keep this room nice and warm. And that keeps all of us nice and warm at home. Or if you have a gas stove or something like that, that's what you're burning in your gas stove probably, unless you happen to have propane around. Or C6H12O6, that's good old glucose, that energy, that stuff you just ate for dinner over there, that's going to give you energy to stay alive and play the games tonight and hopefully get some sleep and then wake up tomorrow morning ready to roll, right? So those are all standard carbohydrate molecules, or carbon and oxygen. Now, when you start looking at the carbon atom, you can imagine the angels, the fun they had with this. When they put our world together and you have these carbon atoms. So when they go to build carbon, the atom that life is built on, you know, at the subatomic level, we finally find out someday that the actual atom you start with to build all the molecules of life, carbon. I remember going through this with the kids at school, and I said, all right, what has it got? How many protons? 6. How many neutrons? 6. How many electrons? 6. And I sat there stunned. I realized that, wow, the atom that builds life is 666. I'll tell you, that can't possibly be by random chance. It's God's put these things in there that are for people that are looking for them. If you're looking, you start seeing things and patterns that are there that are just amazing and they're beyond belief. And I think that probably also indicates that in the age to come, I doubt whether the angels are built from carbon. I don't really think you're going to find that our new bodies that we get are going to be built from carbon like everything is today. But all the animals, all the plants, all the bacteria, all the molecules of life are all built from 666 on this planet today. And that's the way God made it. So carbon atoms, that's what they do. They bond with hydrogens, they bond with oxygens, whatever they can get, because they need to share those electrons. They want to get more than 6 in the end, but that's all that they have to start with, and that is the molecule of life. Oh, by the way, I always throw in at this point, it's always fun to look at concepts that you can relate to, that you've heard about in the news or something. So when you ate dinner tonight, and you go over there and you have your salad, and then you put some of that nice dressing on the top of your healthy salad, right? You hope that those fats that are in that dressing aren't those kind that are going to ruin all the good high quality of that salad for you, all that good nutrition that's there. But if you load it up with all that dressing on the top, some of you probably know that dressing, do I even need this thing on? Do you need this in the back? Okay, so we'll leave it on. That dressing stuff has fats in it. Now, some of those fats are saturated, some of them are unsaturated. Anybody even know why we call them saturated and unsaturated fats? Anybody know why? Which one's better for you? Which one's better for you? Oh, you know that one, see? All right. Which one's better to eat?
The unsaturated
fats. All right, so you want to, when you're looking at products at the store, you always want to get the ones that say unsaturated, which, by the way, most plants make unsaturated fats, the oils, whereas animals, they create saturated fats, all that good bacon grease. So you can always tell the difference because when you let the stuff solidify after it's been in the pan, anything that turns solid is saturated, and the stuff that stays oily is unsaturated. It's a lot easier for your body to break down unsaturated fats. So when you use those terms, and do you know why they call them saturated and unsaturated? Anybody even know? What does the word saturated mean? When something's saturated, what does that mean? That's right. It's got as many as it could possibly have. Sort of like, I think some of you guys are saturated right now with that noise. I really don't know what that is. Anybody know why it's doing that? Anybody know? Even when I'm in the middle here, it's still like making that noise. So I don't know what that's connected to. Anyways, so saturated fats, if you're wondering what they are, all that simply means is that all those carbon atoms right there in the middle, those little black guys, have as many hydrogens as you can possibly put. When they do that, the molecules mimic a solid, and you end up with saturated fat solids like bacon grease, which are really tough for your body. They block your arteries and all that kind of stuff. On the other hand, you have the unsaturated guys like this. They bend, they flex, they're oils. A lot easier for your body to decompose and digest and get rid of. And that's why the unsaturated fats are the better ones for you. Anybody know what scientists have learned to do with nice, unsaturated, oily fats? What have we learned to do?
We've
learned to take good, nice vegetable oils and saturate them with hydrogens to mimic these guys right there. And those are the ones they keep telling you today. Stay away from those things that say they're pure vegetable oil, but they're full of these hydrogenated fats. See, hydrogenized stuff. That's what they've done to them today. So if you're wondering what all that stuff is in nutrition, that's really what that was about. I think another one, though, that's fun to look at in terms of like what God's done in our world is DNA. I can remember when I was growing up, I was born in the 50s, early 50s, and by the 60s, I was always starting to read about DNA. I was always interested in it because it was coming into the news at a time. That's also at the same time that computers were coming along. Computers were becoming a big thing back in the 50s and the 60s. And it's really fun to look at in terms of like strategies. When scientists were computing, when they were designing computers, and they were trying to figure out, well, what are we going to do with computers? We have to make a choice. Are we going to make them digital or analog? They had to decide. Now, if they go with analog, it was easier to do. It's a lot easier to record the data on analog. What's the problem with analog? Analog. Analog's like your clock that goes around like this. Some of you are looking like analog. What is analog? Analog's like the clock that goes around like this. Digital is the clock that says 5, 6, 7, 8, very specific data points, right? There's no in between with digital. It's either 5 or 6. There's no 5.5. So digital is very exact. Analog is just always on the move. Or to give you an idea, analog would be like, did you guys ever use videotapes? Are you too old or young for that? Or what? Videotapes. So anybody know what happened when you played a videotape? You know what happens when somebody copied a videotape and they copied it again and they copied the copy and they copied the copy and you go home and you put it in your video player? What do you get? Same stuff that came down today. You get snow, right? Because the copy was so bad, you get snow. That's the problem if you go with analog. So the scientists realized, even though it was going to take a lot of data storage and it was going to require processors that were really huge, we're going to go with digital when they made computers. That's what they did because it had to work. It had to be able to copy. It had to be exact. Well, look at what happens when DNA was put together. When God created our world, he would have had the choice of analog versus digital. But if you're going to start out as one cell that day your mom and dad got together, and that was your beginning, and you only have one copy of the code, and you're going to copy that cell, copy all those 3 billion codes, and you're going to do that millions and millions of times so that you can be you today and not full of cancer everywhere, then you better use something that's really good and exact. And so the angels did the same thing. This is what intelligent design is all about. People that have brains and are designing something know that if you go with analog, it's not going to work. You must go with digital. So back in the 50s and the 60s, when they were finally discovering DNA, it turned out that as we were building computers and we were discovering DNA, how it works, it turns out that we had one of the greatest opportunities to look at evidence for creation, because the greatest minds in our world that were putting together our computers were simply mimicking what God had already done with DNA. They end up making the same decision. You go with digital, you go with readers, you have, you know, like these microprocessors like we have in our computers. DNA is a microprocessor as well. It's all so similar to DNA, it's really hard to believe. And this is all happening when you look at the DNA code. This stuff was all developed by these, when you're talking about these computer things, it was all put together by intelligent people before they ever knew about DNA, because the computers were probably 10 to 15, maybe 20 years ahead of the discovery of DNA. So the computer codes are binary, they're zeros and ones, and DNA, on the other hand, is based on four characters. Instead of just zeros and ones, yep, so you got 0, 1, 2, 3 if you want to do numbers. Science people aren't big on numbers. Biology people. Biology people, have you ever noticed they give names to everything? There's no way they're going to give it like 1, 2, 3, 4. They don't do that. The biology people, they name everything. You know, it's got to have a name or it's not really part of science. So instead of going with 0, 1, 2, 3, they go with adenine, thymine, guanine, cytosine. They give everything a name, and that's how they remember them. I think that's just the way they work. But it turned out one of the biggest surprises about DNA, when we were going through school at that time and learning and reading about it, evolutionary scientists had predicted. Now, you think about this for a second. If you finally break the code and you realize how the DNA code works, and you, if you're a follower of evolution and you think life has been changing and evolving over millions, billions of years, would you expect that when your body cells read DNA code, would they read it the same way a bacteria would? See, all the predictions were, no, that couldn't possibly be the case. But when they finally broke the code, when Watson and Crick broke the code in the early 60s, and they finally were able to read the code and figure out, for these three DNA codes, this is the protein, this is the amino acid that you get, and for these three, you get this amino acid, it turned out that all the cells for all the organisms they tested all read the code the same way. See, that's design. That's not random evolution. Somebody designed it that way, and all the organisms on the planet were reading it the same way. I just remember when that came out, it was one of the greatest evidences against what evolution had predicted, and they had no answer for that, other than to just, you don't even hear about it anymore. The stuff that doesn't fit the theory, they just bypass it, move on to something else. And that's what you'll see in school. Nobody even raises the issue anymore. But DNA is universal, and the reader is universal. DNA's got a reader, just like computers have readers. They have processors like that, and they read it in three-letter codes. I remember my first computer I had was an old TRS-80. We used to call them trash 80s from Radio Shack. And when you would copy a file, you used to be able to see what the computer would tell you, reading, and then a few seconds later, writing, and then a few seconds later, verifying, and you get to see all this stuff happening. Now your computers work so fast, they don't even bother telling you all that stuff. But that's what they used to do. And it turned out that when they studied DNA, that the proteins that unwind your DNA, they read your DNA, they copy your DNA, and they actually verify, just like the computers did. It's just fascinating to watch how good, intelligent people created a system that was identical to what angels had done in our creation. It's intelligent design. So when you go to read DNA, some of you probably learned this in school, when you go to read it, how many codes do you read at once? You read it, and they call it a triplet code. You always read three letters at a time. So anybody that can read that can read DNA. That's all you have to know, how to read the three letters. You have to be able to decode them. So you have to know that when you read the word big, you have to know sometimes like, what does big mean? Well, you have an idea what big means. So when you read the three letters in DNA, you have to realize which amino acid that will sequence. But it turned out DNA was really, really simple to read, really simple to understand. The amazing thing about DNA is that it was so long, long. It takes huge processors to be able to do this. Really fast enzymes that can copy DNA molecules. It's extremely, extremely long. 3 billion codes in each one of your cells. 3 billion. I don't think most of us actually realize what 3 billion is. 3 billion, that's a lot of codes. So when you look at a DNA molecule, all it is just this backbone that's made out of sugars and phosphates, and then you've got those four different letters sitting there in the middle and how they match up. And that's all it takes for DNA when you go to read the code. You just read along there and you can figure out what the DNA molecule is and what proteins it's going to actually code for. Now, when we say that every cell in your body has 3 billion codes, 3 billion, what do you think about that Bible on your lap? You think your Bible, does your Bible have 3 billion letters in it? 3 billion. Does it have 3 billion letters? What do you think? Because otherwise we just throw around numbers and people, this is the problem in biology. Biologists throw around numbers all the time and they're not really statisticians. They're not math people. They don't understand what 3 billion really means. It's easy to say 3 billion, but do you really know what 3 billion is? 3 billion. So what do you think? That Bible right there, do you think that's got 3 billion letters in it? 3 billion. Come on, you have to, a good scientist always wager a guess.
Yes.
Yes. So she goes with yes. How many people support her? How many? You've got less than 3 billion, you've got more than 3 billion letters in your Bible, right? You believe that?
Yep.
You believe that? All right. Anybody know whether we have 3 billion letters in our Bible?
No.
All you gotta do is get out your phone and Google it. How many letters are in the Bible? There's nowhere near 3 billion. Oops. So what do you think? Maybe five Bibles? Five Bibles. Will that do it? If you stacked up five Bibles, counted all the letters, is that 3 billion codes? Nah, not 3 billion codes. Believe it or not, you need about 100 Bibles. Can you imagine stacking up 100 Bibles, looking at that, and realizing that all those letters are in every cell of your body, and you have to copy all those exactly right, and your body's doing this thousands of times a day, copying all those codes and sending and creating new cells to replace dead ones, or ones that are worn out, don't work anymore. And you've been doing this ever since you were one cell. This system is very exact. It's got to work really well. But that's a lot of code. You're looking at almost 100 Bibles to get 3 billion codes. So when people throw numbers around like that, you have to get some kind of reference point that you realize what 3 billion is. That's a lot of code to copy. That's a lot of code to analyze. That's why it took so long to try to figure out the human genome. You know, you're starting to read. If you want to read all the code in 100 Bibles, that takes a long time when they were reading them one at a time when they first started out. So here, I'll give you an example of how you can read DNA. You can see how simple this is. But here is I like the circular chart. Most of your textbooks probably had the old rectangle things, but the circular ones are actually easier to use. So if you saw a piece of DNA, or actually this is RNA, because first of all, when you make a protein, your body copies from DNA to RNA, and then RNA actually does all the work. So in RNA, you've got A's and U's and G's and C's. So if you saw AUG, all you got to do is go down here to the code book and say, all right, A, we start here with A, and then we read U, and then we go down to G. So there's AUG. That first amino acid is going to be methionine, which is what most of your proteins start out with. They start with a methionine. They call that the first methionine. And then you read UGG right there. So you start with U, and then the G, and then the G, and you get this tryptophan stuff. That's the one that after you eat a nice turkey Thanksgiving meal, they blame for putting you to sleep. Tryptophan, because that tends to make people sleepy. I think some of you maybe ate too much of that for dinner tonight. You see, it's not your fault, it's the tryptophan. You gotta remember to tell the teachers, it's not my fault, it's the tryptophan. It's putting me to sleep. So that amino acid is actually linked in with making people really tired. But that's all it takes to read DNA. It's really not very complicated. But when scientists finally did all this stuff and they started working with DNA, some huge things came up in evolutionary theory that were just total flaws to evolutionists. When Charles Darwin had first proposed natural selection as a mechanism for evolution, he had talked about simple organisms, like simple things, and they always picked on the amoeba as being like the simple amoeba, and said, well, maybe they were the first organisms, and then from there things got more complex. But amoebas were sort of looked at as being like the first simple organisms. Well, it turns out that when you study amoebas, that when you go into the nucleus of an amoeba and you look at its codes right there in the nucleus, they've got 96 chromosomes and 200 times more DNA than humans. That's not quite so simple. Not simple. And the more you study amoebas and you find out how they work, they have really complex things in amoebas just like your cells have. They're really just as complex as any one of the cells in your body. There's no such thing as a simple cell. That whole idea turned out to be a fallacy. There are no simple cells. It takes a lot of codes to run a cell because they have to do the same processes, whether they're one cell or whether they're just one cell inside a multicellular organism. So that whole idea that you used to hear about in science about simple organisms and fitting into evolutionary theory, that was a huge mistake that scientists made. All these things turned out to be a lot more complex than anybody had ever imagined. There really are no simple cells on this planet. They are all extremely complex, and DNA has actually helped us understand that. Even bacteria, those little guys right there that get inside you and cause you all kinds of trouble, bacteria turn out to be really complex little guys because it takes a lot of DNA to run a bacterium, just like it does for you. The difference with bacterium, anybody know what's different about their DNA versus ours? Bacterium, their DNA is circular. Their DNA wraps around, goes all the way around and all the way around, and it connects. It connects. Anybody know why that's really cool to have connecting DNA? Yeah, the ends of the chromosomes never wear out. There's no limit to how many times they can reproduce, and that's why bacteria end up being immortal. They can just keep reproducing, reproducing, and reproducing. Anyway, that's pretty interesting. In fact, when they started looking at that and realizing when the chromosomes wear out like that and you start limiting the growth of your cells, turned out that's why, have you ever seen pictures of kids that have progeria? You ever seen little kids that look like they're really old and they're only like 5 years old and they look like they're 60 or 70 years old? They have a disease called progeria. The ends of their chromosomes don't restore, and so they end up being really old real fast. Now, that Ebola virus, you heard about that in the news lately? Yeah, Ebola viruses. So when you start looking at an Ebola virus, that stuff over in Africa that's caused so much trouble, this one's called a filovirus. It's like a little worm. It's not like a bacterium. But that virus itself is just based out of, you know, got a little RNA strand right there. It's single-stranded RNA covered by a capsid right there, which is a protein capsid. And then you got protein around the outside. It's really just a bunch of RNA code, just like DNA code, inside this thing. And look at all the trouble that it causes. It gets into people's lives and it wrecks their body, it ruins their cells. But viruses, by scientists, are currently not considered to be alive. You'll hear it in the news every so often. You hear when Ebola strikes up, they'll talk about the virus and the people on the news, they talk like it's alive. Viruses aren't considered to be alive because they cannot exist on their own. They can't run any of the metabolic processes that your body does. They have to take over a living cell and borrow all the machinery off of them. When you look at ecosystems, I know in science a lot of you study ecosystems because that became a big issue in science and a big issue in society because we've ruined ecosystems so much. But when you look at the delicate balance that's in ecosystems, and I know some of you had this in your science classes, look at how delicately they're put together so that when one thing happens in an ecosystem and you introduce a pollutant into the water right there, and this fish are swimming around and they get it into them, and then the birds eat that, and in turn it just goes all through the animals of the ecosystem, you can cause a lot of trouble in ecosystems when you introduce pollutants like that. They really are put together with a delicate balance. And yet it's amazing how when the angels made our world, they made it so flexible and so that it can bend and flex with all the different things that happen with climatic change and with stuff that we've introduced, and everything is still, for the most part, still surviving. That takes design to do that. That's not something that comes by random chance. By the way, when you're reading through those early chapters of Genesis this week, and you're reading Genesis 1, and you're reading all those different things, this is one of the greatest evidences that in Genesis 1, when it talks about day 1 and day 2 and day 3, those really were 24-hour days, because the ecosystems don't work if you just introduce plants, and then 1,000 years later you give them light cycles. You can't do that with plants. They need the light cycles for them to work. So day four had to come right after day three. And when you have all those different plants, they don't function without the animals there as well. It was a package deal that God put into our ecosystems. And you can find that when you're looking at science and you try this stuff if you tried long periods without light, you'd find out it just doesn't work. They all die. So the ecosystems, I'm amazed at how resilient they are. When you look at things that have hit the natural things like floods and forest fires, we get some of those out in California, and you get mudslides, and you get hurricanes, and you get tornadoes out here. But all the different things that have come naturally, or even the human things that we've introduced, our ecosystems are amazingly resilient. And that takes brains to do that. That's design. That's angels that are monitoring our world today, and they're fixing things. They put in automatic buffer things in our world so that if we put out too much carbon dioxide in our world because we're burning too much gas, we're burning too much gasoline in our cars, and carbon dioxide is going up into the air, they've got plants in the oceans that are just like pulling it in and pulling it out of the air. And they're creating, they're trying to restore that balance. That takes design to pull that off. That's not something that just happens automatically. When you go back and look at our ecosystems today as to why there is so much stress on them, I don't know whether you've ever seen any charts that map out the human population from the years back from like, you know, back 4000 BC, you're coming along. Look what's happened in the last, 200 years or so. Our human population has just shot up like that to where now we're looking at 7 billion people on this planet. 7 billion because of technology. People don't die anymore like they used to. Children don't die. We don't get plagues like we used to. Maybe Ebola comes along, but somebody will figure out how to cure Ebola. They come up with strategies that work. People don't die anymore of things that used to wipe out our world. And because of that, we've got a huge human population explosion lately, which is probably an indication that we're really near the time of the end. The planet really can't continue going. I can still remember back in the 70s when scientists had predicted ahead of time, you know, according to their theories, that if you went down in the ocean near the bottom of the Pacific Rift, if you went way down there, you know, a few miles down in the ocean, would you expect to find anything alive? What's it like down there? It's cold, it's dark, and there's a tremendous amount of pressure that far down. All the predictions in science were nothing would be alive. Until in the 1970s when they sent down these unmanned these submersibles that go down there and they search, like the ones that they were using to search for the airplanes that had fallen into the ocean, the missing Malaysian planes and stuff. They found out when you go down miles down, they found these things called black smokers. And what they're doing is they're putting out hydrogen sulfide, which is nasty stuff, coming up from where the lava down below the surface at the rift where these cracks are in the plates. The water, the ocean water is mixing with this stuff and it creates hydrogen sulfide at that point, which is a terrible poison for us. And lo and behold, what did they find down there? They found living organisms. They found out there's bacteria that live on these black smokers and down below. There's clams, there's all kinds of life down in there. And the biggest surprise of all was what these bacteria do is they live off of hydrogen sulfide and they break it down. It's so that God put filters down there, miles down in the ocean that nobody even knew about, that were cleaning up the hydrogen sulfide so that we don't get poisoned up here on Earth. And nobody even knew this until they finally discovered it in the late 70s, early 80s. You know, it's one of these great testimonies to design. Somebody has organized an entire ecosystem way down below in the ocean, what we didn't even know about, that's actually protecting and filtering our planet. Great stuff down there. But you know, you barely hear about it. When you look at some of the flaws in evolutionary theory, I don't know. I don't think we're going to get to that tonight, but that's okay. I think I'll just leave it there because I could talk about this all night. But I know you guys are ready to get on with the games, and I am going to return that ping pong ball so you can play that whole game. And anyway, so that's just. I hope that gives you some idea. When you hear at school or you hear about people talking about science versus the Bible, you don't have to be afraid of talking about science and the Bible. Really, the two of them do fit together. The mistakes that have been made sometimes in evolutionary theory and stuff that have gone on, it's just errors in people's interpretation of data. And it's just stuff that you got to work on and try to work through. But don't ever get scared off by thinking that in some way that science is going to disprove the Bible. In no way. There's so many things we have found that support design in our world. it's just hard to find out about them today because they don't filter up through and they don't get into the textbooks, they don't get into the magazines. And when they do get in there, people present them with a view that they put a different spin on it, so you don't really see what they were really originally thinking. So I'll leave it at that and have fun with the games.